We're looking here now in chapter 4, or part 4 of section 1 of the halachic man. Again, halachic man is divided into two major parts. It's a little confusing because I think they both carry Roman numerals, so it's even hard to effectively summarize. But the smaller sections, this part 4 you see here, chapter 4, this is chapter 4 of part 1, although part 1 is significantly longer than part 2. Part 1 runs about almost 90-100 pages. Part 2 is only about 40 pages. And part 1 can really be subdivided into two larger sections. Although there are 15 of these chapters, chapter 1 through 10, which we are now in the middle of, chapter 1 through 10 is this a comparison of these three typological characters, of halachic man, of homo religiosus, religious man, and of course cognitive man, who we've identified as the scientist, and the comparison of their three personalities, but particularly their three approaches to reality. And if you recall our discussion last week, by reality I don't mean reality TV. I mean the world, the physical world which we occupy, as opposed to some transcendental realm or spiritual realm. It's not fair to use the term, it's not accurate to use the terms Olam Hazeh and Olam Haba, this world and the next world, because that's imprecise. Talking about the physical created world versus the spiritual world, the transcendental world. And the first 10 chapters analyze their differences. And again, just by way of summary, both halachic man and cognitive man, I'm sorry, strike that, say it again, both homo religiosus, religious man, and cognitive man have a kind of either-or approach to the tension between the two realms. It's either this or it's that. Again, just by way of summary from last time. Actually, let me look at that chart that we looked at last time. There you go. Again, cognitive man, doesn't at all pay attention to the realm of the spirit, to the transcendental realm, to the higher world. He is focused exclusively on the created world, the physical world, the material world that we occupy. Homo religiosus, who of course recognizes the spiritual world, is of course, and this is the topic of tonight's discussion, is of course aware that we live in a material world. He can't deny that. He can't deny the fact that we live in a created world. But he's always trying to figure out how we can get out of this world into the next, how we can literally transcend. That's why the upper realm is the transcendental. Halachic man has a different approach. It's not either this or that. In other words, for cognitive man, it's the material world. He's unaware of the spiritual realm. Homo religiosus is aware of both, but he's trying to flee the lower in order to get to the higher. He's quite literally trying to negate one in favor of the other. Halachic man is aware of the tension that exists between the two, and he is trying to, almost the opposite of homo religiosus, he's trying to bring the realm of the spirit down into the realm that we exist for the reasons that we discussed last week by way of summary and which we will continue to explore as we move along. That is the topic of the first 10 chapters of section 1 that we are now about to start the fourth chapter of. And then chapters 11 through 15 of section 1 is much more a discussion of this latter point of how halachic man attempts to create this bridging of the worlds through the mechanism of the halacha, and particularly how he differs in the last five chapters or so of section one, particularly how he differs from homo religiosus, from the conventional or classically defined religious personality. Okay, that it looks like some kind of football playbook by the time we're done, but that's the quick summary. And there it is on the board. And those of you that follow along in the archives, I apologize. There was some snafu in the recording last week, and I believe only the audio recording is available. But this is the chart we were looking at last week, and now you have it again, kind of outlined on the video as well. Now let's go back here. The understanding of reality of the religious man, of homo religiosus. And again, homo religiosus, religious man, is not necessarily the Jewish religious man. And in some ways, as you'll see, he bears certain very strong, probably certain very strong Christian connotations. This characteristic attitude of homo religiosus towards existence, as described earlier, directly entails the following conclusion. Everything that we've said about homo religiosus up until now brings us to the following conclusion. Homo religiosus does not acknowledge any ontic monism. Let's explain that. Reality for him is not uniform and monochromatic, but rather pluralistic and multi-layered. Pluralistic here is not used in the kind of colloquial way we talk about pluralism, about different groups getting along, an argument for pluralism that says that Orthodox, conservative, and Reformed Jews, we can be pluralistic and we can all get along. That's not what we're talking about here. Here the pluralism is the pluralism that I just described, the pluralism of both worlds, upper and lower. It's not monastic. It's not only one realm. Cognitive man has a monism from one. He sees only the material realm. He's completely unaware of the other. Homo religiosus, you might think, I mean, if I were to tell you, set up these two straw men, as these kind of contrasting characters, you might have thought that it would look something like this. Cognitive man dismisses the realm of the spirit and focuses only on the realm of the material. You might have thought that religious man certainly recognizes the realm of the spiritual and dismisses the realm of the material, except he can't dismiss the realm of the material because willy-nilly we are caught in it. We are, after all, created beings. So there, he does recognize that pluralism, that there's both mala-mala and mala-mata, because he lives there, because he is a physical being. Even homo religiosus feels the grumbling in his tummy and knows he needs lunch and knows, therefore, that he is not an angel. He is, instead, a man, a created physical being. Ontic pluralism is the very foundation of the worldview of homo religiosus. And that awareness of both above and below is the axis around which his entire personality spins. When he approaches the world in order to cognize and evaluate it, he attempts to find in this concrete and physical world the traces of higher worlds. Now, this is important. Even homo religiosus also cognizes. He is also a cognitive man, right? In that sense, he's not the mirror image of cognitive man. He has something in his personality that attempts to make understanding of his world, right? But not with the same impulse of the scientist, for a different person. When he looks at the world and tries to understand it, and here we are repeating things that the Rav is repeating things that he said earlier. When he looks at the world and tries to evaluate it, cognition and evaluation, two hallmarks of the scientific method. But when the religious man does it, he attempts to find in this concrete and physical world the traces of higher worlds. He's looking in art, they always say that no matter how perfect the work of art, there's always the fingerprint of the artist. I mean, either literally, sometimes they'll find that as Rembrandt was painting the canvas, his fingers brushed up against the wet paint and quite literally left fingerprints. But even if it's not the literal fingerprints, there's the figurative fingerprints that every artist leaves something, some resonance, some residue of himself in the work. So looking at the world is a way to look for the divine. Let me take a look at look at this chat. Someone sent to me privately. I'm not sure if it was meant to be sent to me privately or if it's meant for everybody, but the person asks about, by way of example, bringing brachot, that a bracha is meant to transform a material into a spiritual, material elements into a spiritual one. For example, blessings on food. It takes a very physical element, and with the blessing, it changes. It may not be the word I really want to use, the person writes. The act of eating food into a spiritual act. So is that the halachic manner? Is that the homo religiosus taking the material and moving into the spiritual? It's a good question. It depends on how you interpret the act of saying blessings. Presumably, the halachic man and the homo religiosus would both recite blessings before food. And after all, Judaism is not the only faith tradition that has a notion of saying blessings before or after eating, but presumably each of them would do it from a different kind of point of view, or the experience would be interpreted differently. Right. So Peter raises the question of Gnosticism, which there's more to say about that. Halachic man, again, don't confuse halachic man, Miriam, since he feels a chiyuv to do it, an obligation, a halachic obligation. Don't confuse halacha with a capital H and halacha with a lowercase h. So when homo religiosus looks at the world, he's looking for the traces of the higher world, all of which are holy, good, and eternal. He seeks to discover the source of the plenitude and being and of the fullness of the cosmos in supernal ontic realms. Supernal is a word the Rav uses frequently. I mean, it just quite literally means, like, super means above, or beyond. So supernal just quite literally means, like celestial, heavenly, mala mala, that which is above. El Yom, yeah. The supernal ontic realms are the pristine and pure. I'm going to come back to this in a second when we talk about Plato. This transcendent approach to reality constitutes a primary feature of the profile of the man of God. Homo religiosus is dissatisfied, unhappy with this world. He searches for an existence that is above empirical reality. He lives in this world, the physical realm that we occupy, but he's looking for something beyond it, above it. Rabbi Soloveitchik famously had described, and we had studied it together. It's mentioned in a few places, but also in the Lilian Man of Faith, the idea of Kedusha, of Kadosh, that God is holy, that holiness somehow means transcendent. It's those moments at which we can, as it were, cast a line and hit a remote mark. That sense of transcendence, that sense of being beyond the trappings of our own physical realm that we're in, and to touch something, well, to connect with God. So the idea that kadosh, 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 transcendent, 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 is the way the Rav very poetically put it. That's what homo religiosus strives for. The fact that we're comparing, and not always favorably, we're comparing homo religiosus to halachic man, and of course halachic man is the hero of the work, does not in any way mean that we disparage or negate this desire of homo religiosus for the transcendent. This world is a pale image of another world. Cognitive man, on the other hand, is not concerned at all with the reality that extends outside the realm of lawfulness. Lawfulness being doesn't mean law and order. Lawfulness doesn't mean don't go over the speed limit. Although you shouldn't do that either. Lawfulness here meaning a world governed by the laws of nature, a world governed by the laws of of physics. To quote that great Rebbe, I cannot change the laws of physics. That's what it means to live in a universe of lawfulness. And cognitive man has no relationship with any mode of being that is beyond empirical reality and scientific understanding. It just doesn't register for him. For the law is his goal, and lawfulness is always and only to be found within a context of concreteness. And then he mentions Immanuel Kant, who I mentioned a few weeks ago. Kant's Critique of Pure Reason, this incredibly important work in the history of philosophy, the Critique of Pure Reason by Immanuel Kant. Here we have where is it? There he is. There's Immanuel Kant. There's the Critique of Pure Reason. This incredibly important 18th century work. Kant established the bounds of space and time as the limits of comprehension. That was the innovation of Kant, that man is not capable of having any understanding or insight into that which is beyond the realm in which we live. We live in the physical realm. We live in a realm that's limited by space and time. And beyond that, it's all speculation. Kant was not Nietzsche. Kant did not say that God did not exist or that God was dead. He was just saying it's all in the blind, and we can't have anything to say or to understand beyond the realm in which we occupy. A part of Kant's contribution to the history of ideas leads to a philosophical approach that can get to the point where God is effectively removed from our reality. But that limiting of man's ability to have an understanding of something, the phenomenological approach, where all we can do is think about or cognize or understand the phenomena of this world that we experience, that shrinking of the philosophical arena, away from theological matters, away from transcendental matters, that was the contribution of Kant to world philosophy. So Kant established the bounds of space and time as the limits of comprehension. Cognitive man pays no attention to and is wholly uninterested in a world that is above the rule of the empirical reality. Cognitive man is a Kantian. If it's not of this world, then it's off my map. The object with which he is concerned is completely hemmed in by the total physical and psychical reality. Right? His playing field of interest is Olam Hazeh. But homo religiosus, on the other hand, passes beyond the realm of concreteness and reality set within the frame of scientific experience and enters into a higher realm. Homo religiosus, religious man, religious experience, does not limit itself to the Kantian phenomena of the physical reality and is prepared to attempt to understand and attempt to explore that which is beyond. And then the Rav has this long paragraph. Indeed, the echo of the longings of homo religiosus for a supernal existence succeeds from time to time in making itself heard in the world of knowledge and science. And even in the world of knowledge and science, both that before Kant and after Kant, that desire, that longing for the supernal, that longing for a glimpse of that which is beyond, does from time to time make its impact in the world of knowledge and science. And then he gives a long list of references, starting with Plato and the paradigm for true being, the realm of phenomena as the shadows of being. I'm going to come back to that in a second. Aristotle, Philo, the Neoplatonic school, Spinoza, Kant and Kantianism, Arabic philosophy, Christian scholasticism, the phenomenological approach of Husserl and Scheler, who were two important, of course, German philosophers that came after Kant, modern metaphysics, which attempts penetrate the absolute being. Epistemological idealism. Berkeley, Hermann Cohen, who, of course, famous German-Jewish philosopher, who was, of course, the subject of Rabbi Soloveitchik's doctoral dissertation, etc., etc. All of these figures, and I'm not going to now unpack each of them and show how each of them demonstrate elements of the longing for the supernal existence making itself heard in the world of knowledge and science as demonstrated in different ways by each of these. But a trip through the Encyclopedia of Philosophy or even a visit to Wikipedia would fill in your philosophical learning on each of these different entries highlighted on the page. But all of them constitute traces of religious thought which yearns for its creator and rebels against the concrete reality that so entirely surrounds it. That each of them, in one way or another, even if it's only by way of negation, is occupied with this question of mala mala umala mata. That's my phraseology, not the Rav's. I'm borrowing that from the famous Mishnah. What's above, what's below, what's beyond this world? Even Kant, who makes the forceful argument that we can't know what's beyond, is very much occupied with a discussion of that which is beyond. I have a friend, someone from high school, who it's been many years since high school, and for many years we weren't in touch. And recently we reconnected. That's part, of the benefits of the wired world. Over the years he became very much less religious. But I tell him all the time that he's the most religious person I know, because all he does in every conversation I have with him is talk about mitzvot, all the mitzvot that he doesn't do. But he's very fixated on it, and he wants me to know all about it. Many of my religious friends do not speak quite so frequently about mitzvot, neither the ones they do nor the ones they don't do. So even, by the way, I'm here speaking tongue-in-cheek, but it comes back to what we talked about last week, about negative cognition, that even that which you don't know is a statement about that which you know. Even that what you don't perform, is a statement about your relationship to mitzvot. I'm speaking lightly here, but I think you get the point that I'm making. That even the negation of the realm beyond represents not the negation of its existence, but the negation of our ability to say anything about it, says a lot about it. A soul overwhelmed by religious longings may, at certain times, stray amid the paths of secular knowledge. That's a great line. That's really a great line. A soul overwhelmed by religious longings may, at certain times, stray amid the paths of secular knowledge. I mean, that's really, and he's really being ironic here, the Rav. He's being very, it's almost, he must have chuckled writing that line. That even within the realms of the German universities of the early 20th century, you can't be a philosopher of ideas, of serious ideas, of serious philosophy, without considering certain subjects. And regardless of where you come down on the point, willy-nilly, you are forced to wrestle with matters of significant theology. This idea, just to take one of them, and to start with Plato, the paradigm of true being and the realm of the phenomena as the shadows of being. This is the famous Platonic divide. Plato suggested that our world, the world which we actually occupy, the one we're all, to the best of my knowledge, Rebbe Shiva has not succeeded in broadcasting outside of the realm that we live in. But if there's anybody out there elsewhere in the universe that's listening into the archives, please drop us a note, let us know. The physical world that we occupy is a shadow, is a reflection of what's come to be known as the Platonic world. Of course, taking its name from Plato, but meaning an ideal world, and the real always somehow falls short of the ideal, that somehow in the projection from the ideal, the Platonic, into the actual, there's something that's gone off. Somehow the image has been degraded. So this idea of the Platonic ideal, well, we all know this. I'm not sure that the example I'm about to give is 100% correct. But think about a child. A child is asked to draw a house. So how does a child draw a house? Well, it usually looks something like this. Pardon my inability to draw well, and its limitations done on the screen, but I think you'll all recognize what I'm doing. When a child has to draw a house, it will inevitably look something like this. So much so that there's a whole field of child psychiatry which will ask children to draw houses and then analyze how their drawing differs from the way that we normally would think of drawing a house. Um, And this would be a kind of reflection of you can't see it. You see it now? Right? But so if you see the house that I've drawn, you would all recognize it as a kind of typical picture of a house, the way that a child would draw a house. Even though most children don't actually live in houses that, I mean, it could be that somewhere in the world there is a house that looks like this, but it's not the house that I grew up in. It probably doesn't look like the house that any of you grew up in, but it is a kind of what we would say a stereotypical house. We have the idea of a platonic house, like an ideal of what a house is, or what a tree is, or what a chair is. And that is somehow reflected into the actual homes that we all live in. And there's going to be a gap between the platonic ideal and the actual real that we live in. It could be the actual real that you live in doesn't look like this. It could be the actual real that you live in has a broken window. It could be the actual real you live in doesn't have green grass or any grass at all. But that doesn't mean that there isn't some kind of ideal tree or ideal house or ideal who knows what in the supernal realm, but not the supernal realm exactly, because that's not the Platonian ideal, but the idea of this Platonic ideal, which is then somehow reflected in reality. And it's not a critique on reality that it doesn't meet the ideal. It's just an idea that if we were to distill what a house is or what a tree is into its kind of ideal form, there'd be some kind of notion of what that is. That there's an ideal tree, but we might actually look around at the trees in our forest and think that none of them meet that ideal of tree-iness. Of house-iness, of chair-iness, but the essence of what chair is, right? Well, that may not actually be true for the chair that I'm sitting in. But it doesn't mean that the chair I'm sitting in doesn't exist. It just means that it is part of the physical, actual, real world, but yet there exists on the realm of ideas, and the Platonic world is only a realm of ideas. Plato didn't think was an actual place where things were actually projected or sent from. But in the essential realm, in the realm of essences, there's a notion of the ideal type of everything, and then it takes on its actual real physical form in our world. Right, exactly. Peter's point is exactly in terms of mathematically and geometry. The idea of the line that connects two points exists just as an ideal. Right? It's a line that has no breadth in it. It can't exist in the real world. When I draw two points and I try to connect it with a line, to demonstrate just for the purposes of my geometry class, I've altered from the ideal, because the actual drawing of the line, which by definition I have to represent it graphically somehow with the line, shows it having some kind of breadth to it. But of course it has no breadth. It's just this kind of imaginary connection between to imaginary points. Excellent example, Peter. Plato also discusses this divide between the Platonic, between the ideal and the actual. And this breaks up as heaven and earth, although his conceptions of heaven were not exactly ours. The perfect, meaning the ideal, versus the corrupted. Here, corrupted not in the sense of, this, it's not a judgment call, but in the real world, there's always going to be a gap from whatever that abstract perfect notion is, the divine versus the human. We are, if we are created in God's divine image, we somehow still manage in this world to to mess it up. Eternal versus finite, spiritual versus material, and that we see in the conversation we've been having up until now, the two different realms that homo religiosus is aware of, although he feels the desire to flee one and enter the other, and the pure versus the, again, contaminated. These are the Platonic divides. So the Rub says, we didn't invent this, and then he gives us this long laundry list of others that have been aware and discussing and playing with this idea of the supernal and the real, the physical realms being in interaction, in tension, and this religious quest, however, does not confine itself solely to theoretical stances and abstract views, but breaks out of the theoretical realm into the realm of praxis and utility. So this quest, the quest of religious man to find the eternal, is not merely theoretical. And you could think that, in fact, it could only be theoretical. In other words, we live in this world. Whether we love it here or we hate it here, whether we feel it's a blessing to be in this realm of geology and butterflies, of supernovas and shooting stars, or we feel trapped like the divine spiritual mitzot that we are, trapped in the vessel of a physical body, whether we are happy to be here or not. So what does it mean to be questing for the supernal? What does it mean to be questing for transcendence? Well, it's only theoretical, since we actually have no way to, we can't build the Tower of Babel to get up to heaven. We can't exit this mortal, we can't shuffle off this mortal coil exactly. So in what way is it anything but some kind of theoretical quest? In what way is it anything beyond just a kind of vague longing? But there is, however, a way that it plays itself out in practice and in the actual realm. And the search for transcendence is transformed from the mere theoretical into an ethical principle. It's through the realm of the ethical that it has practical meaning even in our world. The longing for transcendence presents itself through an ethical impulse. It turns into a pillar of fire that lights the path before the religious individual. This idea of the ethic is not to suggest that cognitive man who does not seek transcendence is ipso facto an unethical person. It means, however, that the source of the ethic comes from a different place. Here we're reminded of the very important and well-known essay by Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein, who is Rabbi Soloveitchik's son-in-law. Rabbi Lichtenstein wrote an essay many years ago called "Does the Jewish Tradition Recognize an Ethic Independent of Halakha?" That essay is available online. If you Google it, you'll find it. I will also send you a link to it. It was made available online as part of some kind of symposium that was held about it, and there are a few interesting papers or summaries of that paper, and I really recommend that article. Does the Jewish tradition recognize an ethic independent of the halakha? The bottom line, which I will do a disservice by summarizing on one foot, is, well, it depends on how you define halakha. If you mean halakha with a lowercase h, meaning synonymous with the Ketzer Shulchan Aruch, synonymous with dry legal codes, so then obviously there's an ethic that's independent of the halakha. But if you mean, thank you, Peter, there you go, Peter just shared the link from this website, www.theapj.com. You can find it there. But I'll send it to you as well in the email you'll be getting in the class for next week. So I strongly recommend that essay. If time were to allow, it would be worth doing a close reading together of that essay, but you can make your way through it on your own. So again, Rabbi Lichtenstein raises this question, and he basically answers it by saying it depends on how you define halakha. Halakha with a capital H in the sense of halachic man. Halakha is synonymous with the larger authentic Jewish worldview, which has the halachic codes, principally the Talmud, but not exclusively, as the raw material of the Jewish worldview, the authentic Jewish worldview. So that would be synonymous with ethics through the mechanism of meta halacha. Meta halacha meaning the larger, that which goes beyond the dry black and white, but is meant to encompass the larger aims of halacha, codes like lifnei mishuras hadin, to go beyond the letter of the law, kedoshim tiyu, the imperative to be holy, vasita dayashar v'hatov, the imperative to seek out goodness and righteousness and proper behavior, that sense that it's not proper, it's antithetical to be the Naval B'Shut HaTorah. You know, one could tiptoe through the raindrops and never technically violate the letter of the law and yet still be a Naval, still be a scoundrel. Since any legal code, divine or man-made, since any written legal code cannot, of course, legislate every single possible variation on every single possible scenario. Once ground rules have been laid down, the Torah then gives larger principles, and those larger, generally ethical principles are meant to guide all of the gray zones, are meant to guide all of the matters which were not technically legislated, but which anybody who really has a sense of what the Torah demands of you would be able to properly intuit what is the correct Jewish Torah halachic thing to do in those cases. And it's the kind of wanting to know only the letter of the law, which is really what gets us in trouble, because you then get fixated on the forest, on the trees, and you miss, becomes all trees and no forest. The ladder of ethical perfection, like the biblical ladder of Jacob, is set upon the earth, upon the ground of concrete reality, and the top of it reaches into the very heavens. Ethics, by definition, are this-worldly. They're guides for proper behavior in the world that we live. But like the ladder, they reach from the earth up to the heaven. The ethical and religious ideal of homo religiosus is the extrication of his existence from the bonds of this world, from the iron chains of empirical reality, laws and judgments, and its elevation to the level of being of a higher man in a world that is wholly good and wholly eternal. And through ethical behavior in this world, it gives us a leg up. It makes us ever more godly. And that is a transcendent act. So you see that the quest for transcendence is not merely theoretical. It has a practical outcome in this world. The aim of religion is to liberate those who are bound in fetters and irons and crown them with the royal crown of the supernal transcendent existence emanating from holy eternal laws. The motif winds its way through the whole experiential fabric of homo religiosus. Of course, this tendency takes on at various times, contradictory forms. Sometimes the craving for transcendence clothes itself in ascetic garb. And now he describes different ways in which, despite this desire to bring transcendence into the world to the ethical, homo religiosus sometimes gets distracted. Craving for transcendence clothes itself in ascetic garb, the act of negation of life in this world. And this is a trend within the history of religion. The attempt to negate this world through asceticism, through giving up rejecting the physical. This, as I mentioned a few times, was never a mainstream Jewish approach. Although, like all long-standing cultures, you can point to certain ascetic trends even within Judaism. It was never a mainstream approach. And as I've told you many times, it was something to which the Rambam was particularly opposed to. It's an act of negation of life in this world and a denial of the worthwhile nature of existence. The longing of homo religiosus for a supernal world that extends beyond the bounds of concrete reality has been embodied in many doctrines of asceticism, renunciation, and self-infliction. At such moments, homo religiosus is of the opinion that suffering, torment, fasting, seclusion are the means which convey eternal felicity to man and to bring him under the wings of the supernal. Whereas that idea within the worldview of religious personality, that we are so oppressed in this world. Let's go back here. Here, that in other words, cognitive man is unaware of the realm of the spirit, and therefore, by definition, only lives the realm of the material. But homo religiosus, who desires the realm of the spirit, the idea that does happen from time to time in the religious worldview of certain religious men, that we are going to attempt to negate the material world through fasting, through abstinence, through a negation, through a value system that tries to eliminate anything about this world, that's a mistake. It also, he doesn't mention it here, but it's also a kind of excess which leads to an ethical shortcoming. Because, well, let's just take by way of example, if you feel that if you have this kind of ascetic ideal where people should manage without or with the bare minimum, I don't mean you should manage without a summer home and a Lexus. I mean you should manage without too much food beyond, some kind of minimal basic calories to keep you, from starving to death. Well, it might make you, if you had such a worldview, it might make you a little bit a little bit deaf to the cries of the poor and the hungry. The individual who forgoes worldly pleasures and renounces temporal life will merit, according to that view, eternal life and lofty exalted existence. At other times, this motif may assume an extreme form of affirmation of the world, of approval of reality, the exact opposite movement. However, even according to this stance, concrete empirical reality serves only as a springboard from which man may make his plunge into the supernal. And it is the supernal realm alone that serves as the object of the religious individual's deepest longing, the goal of his ultimate quest. Naturally, between the two extremes of asceticism on the one hand and affirmation of the world on the other, there are a number of intermediate positions that graph together elements from both stances of great hybrid religious moral systems. Okay. Then he says, from a philosophical perspective, the difference between the approach of self-affliction and that of affirmation of reality is purely an ethical, practical one. And here he lays out that tension, that again, for the religious man, the realm of the ethical is the realm in which it's almost like the litmus test by which we measure his accomplishments. These attitudes towards reality are prevalent both in pantheistic and theistic systems. Theistic, of course, means any religious system, Judaism being one of them, of course, which posits the existence of a personal God, theo meaning God. Pantheism is a worldview that denies the existence of a kind of a supernatural or personal God, but yet recognizes the force that we usually identify as nature or the universe itself as, for all intents and purposes, the same. The nature is a God. This is a view that was most significantly put forth by Spinoza, that very famous Jewish thinker who opened all types of cans of worms in the history of ideas. So these attitudes towards reality are prevalent both in pantheistic worldviews as well as theistic systems, what we would today call religious systems, or certainly Western religion. Each system naturally impresses its own stamp upon the ethical conclusions that flow from the approach of homo religiosus to transcendence, and the various conclusions are by no means similar. The common denominator of all of them is that homo religiosus longs for a refined and purified existence. He exists in this world. Remember, according to Plato, it's a world that's corrupted. It's a world that's material, contaminated, finite. In the words of the Kabbalists, which Rabbi Soloveitchik will yet get to, it's the world of Shvira. It's the broken realm. These ideas do have resonance in Kabbalistic notions of the Shvirat HaKelim, at least within Lurianic Kabbalah, that there's this kind of primordial break, that in this world we live in a broken world that yet has to be repaired. And that idea, there is some resonance here, and the Rav will come back to these Kabbalistic notions, although he was far from being a Kabbalist. So the common denominator is that homo religiosus longs for a refined and purified existence. As long as he does live in this realm, as long as homo religiosus does live in the material world and has not yet succeeded in transcending it and exiting it, he aims to at least purify it, to elevate it, to refine it. The ethical behavior in this world is the means by which that is accomplished by homoreligiosis. Homoreligiosis is not the yogi master sitting on the mountaintop. You know, the reason that they went to those mountaintops, besides the fact that, you know, like on the mountaintop, I guess you couldn't get cable TV or good cell phone reception, which are things that, you know, might distract you from the spiritual quest. But the mountaintops are the places that are the most transcendent, meaning they're the closest to getting off of this world. They're the places where this world reaches highest towards that which is above. So there's symbolism, the idea of sitting up there on the mountaintop. So the idea of the man of the spirit sitting on the mountaintop, cross-legged, moaning the Om, trying to get to transcendence, that's not the transcendence of the homoreligiosis, as the Rav is describing it. The homoreligiosis here really is the homoreligiosis of Western religion, not of Eastern religion. He's in this world, but he wants to refine it, and he does so through ethical behavior. And ethical behavior in this world, which is not to suggest in any way that homoreligiosis, the religious men of Eastern traditions, are not ethical. Presumably they are, or they aren't, or they succeed, or they fail, just like every other religious tradition, our own included. But the idea that transcendence comes through trying to get it right in this world, that's the common denominator of homoreligiosis, who longs for refining the about existence. The riddle in existence and the eternal problem that hovers over the face of being leads him beyond the bounds of concrete reality. And that's how he hopes to piggyback his way, or to rather leapfrog his way out of this world into the next. The next section, chapter 5, begins to unpack halachic man's worldview and his understanding of reality. And that's where we will pick up next week. So please try to read ahead.